Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone. This is Bill Henderson. Tonight, Lori Siebert is on vacation, a well-deserved vacation. I am co-hosting tonight with Chris Holland. I am Chief Investment Officer at Valley National Financial Advisors, and Chris is Director of Research and Investments, also at Valley National Financial Advisors. Welcome to Your Financial Choices. So tonight, we are going to talk about the first half of 2026, and then set up the balance for the rest of the year and what we think could or could not happen. So we have a lot to talk about tonight in the short hour we will be here. We are live and in the studio, and we'll be taking your calls on 610-758-8810. Bob and Cindy are on duty to take your calls for the entire hour. So welcome to the show, Chris. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
Yep. I'm looking forward to our hour together.
Let's dig in.
As if we don't spend enough time together. That's true. To be in the radio station. So, you know, we've had a pretty interesting and rewarding first half of the year. What would you like to point out that has there been anything that surprised you or, that you think is a good thing so far?
Yeah, I would start out by saying I think the last time you and I were here together was back in April. And that was when we were in the midst of, you know, the U.S.-Iran war just kind of getting started. It definitely brought a lot of fear into the markets. We saw a pretty significant, very swift move higher in oil prices. And it created just a lot of uncertainty. There was a lot of fear. I think investors overall were just kind of concerned, like, are these higher oil prices going to cause the consumer to just dial back their spending, get a lot more cautious? Is it going to create uncertainty with corporate America? Are businesses just going to become a little bit more cautious? Are they going to dial back their spending plans for AI? That's been a huge theme that you and I have talked about here many times before. So I'd say like the biggest surprise to me is, you know, we are still in the middle of kind of this conflict with Iran. Oil prices are down significantly from the peak we were at, you know, just a few months ago, where, you know, we were hovering around the $110-$120 range for WTI, that's West Texas Intermediate. Today, we're around $85. But what else has happened between, you know, April and today is we've had a lot of really good corporate earnings. You know, corporate America has delivered. We're seeing double-digit earnings per share growth, broadly speaking, for like the S&P 500. You know, the U.S. consumer, I think the theme that you and I hear constantly all day long from the economists that we speak to and the market, you know, professionals is that the U.S. Consumer is definitely very resilient. They've continued to spend. They've gotten more comfortable or just not comfortable, but just been able to kind of manage the higher energy prices with the idea that And I think you and I will agree, is hopefully this conflict is going to be shorter and not longer, and that hopefully we will have some level of resolution. But, corporate America earnings have been better than expected. Consumers holding up well. And just overall, the investments that we're seeing in artificial intelligence, there's been no pullback. I know we've talked about that in the past, are we overspending? But, you know, a lot of good elements are at work right now.
Yeah, you've mentioned quite a number of things we want to kind of unpack for the rest of the hour here. But, you know, year to date, the S&P's up 10%, the NASDAQ 11%, the Dow Jones 9%. So like an equal weighted portfolio is also up 12%. And then the bond market, you know, it's pretty much flat year to date.
Yep.
So a portfolio of made up of roughly 60-40 bonds is you're somewhere between 6.5% and 7%, which given it's only halfway through the year is really not a bad return. The one thing I will comment, you said it a little bit, you know, with April when we had an almost 10% correction, which was pretty dramatic. But I think corrections are good things. They flush out a little bit of the overpricing and a little bit of the expectation and a little bit of the exuberance that our recently deceased friend Alan Greenspan used to say, irrational exuberance. But I think that's a good thing that pullbacks and sell-offs take out of the market. But year-to-date, I think most folks that have stayed invested should be pretty happy. And oil has come down a bit. You know, gasoline is still, you know, a little bit over $4 at least.
I filled up today.
Yeah, $4.49, I think I paid.
For me, $3.99 today.
Well, where do you get the $3.99? Well, we'll talk about that
special
later.
Special places.
Yeah, I got to find out where that is. But and you also talked about AI. You know, this incredible investment into AI. There's billions and billions of dollars. And you know, when will it stop? And are we going to see true return on investment? So tonight, I know we watched it. You know, Google announced their earnings, and this is the very first of the Mag 7 that is releasing its second quarter earnings. And they beat on both revenue and earnings, but you know, the market sort of snoozed. You know, anymore, you could beat by $2 and $3, and it's still a snoozer. What do these companies have to show for the markets to say, okay, that was a really great beat? You know, it's a really good thing. We're happy about it.
I think a lot of it has to do with just when the management team reports the current quarter earnings, they also give some indication on how, you know, what they feel about the future, the quarter ahead, and they give some indication on, hey, here's what we think we can grow at maybe in 2027. It's, I think, that forward guidance that a lot of people are just really concerned about. You know, the growth numbers we've seen have just been spectacular, but how sustainable, I think, is that is I think what the big question that's on, you know, many investors' minds. Is this a couple years of just extravagant, like spectacular spending, or is this going to last for many, many years? And we're just at the beginning of it. And that's where I think the debate is daily on a lot of
this. Yeah, I think we spent a lot of money investing and starting on this, and we're going to start to see the return on investments. And you mentioned a few things, parts of the economy that I really like to pay attention to: the consumer, employment, payroll gains, balance sheets, all of that still in great shape. I will say that everyone, economists, experts, all the so-called folks out there that think they know everything, they have greatly underestimated the U.S. economy for well over 3 years now.
Yeah,
you know, it is going still going very strongly and doesn't show any signs of slowing down. At least that's what we talk about all the time.
Yeah, you and I, we talk to economists from the biggest Wall Street firms out there. And I think you and I could definitely say, like, over the past couple months, we've seen some of those folks come out and at times they'd raise their expectations for some sort of a recession potential or an economic slowdown. But what we've seen over the last month or so is they've dialed that back. Everyone's feeling a little bit more comfortable with the outlook, the strength of the consumer, and that, you know, we have an employment market that's holding up pretty well.
Yeah, it really is. We're still at 4.2% unemployment, which is near full employment. And I looked today at some foreign countries' employment rates, and I was shocked that we are in a very strong position compared to a lot of Europe, especially with young folks. A lot of people say young folks aren't working, but our unemployment rate is still low compared to the rest of the world, which really puts us in a great position going forward. I mean, as people retire, you know, they move into a whole different spending and saving pattern. But, you know, the young folks are the ones we want to continue to work and have opportunities. And we'll get into that a little bit later. But we are coming up in a minute or so on our first break. And what I want to cover after the break is things that you think potentially we missed in the second half in a good way. Like maybe we underestimated a potential for, you know, earnings in a particular segment that really had a gangbuster quarter. And is that something that could happen again in the next quarter? Or is it something that we think, okay, it happened, it was an anomaly, we missed it, but no big deal? Because I think there are some segments that haven't yet performed. You know, you look at the Mag 7, it's kind of down or flat
year-to-date,
for the year.
Year-to-date, that group has underperformed a little bit. So it's, you know, it'll be interesting to see, can they bounce back? Will the earnings results we see kind of be the trigger to people, you know, for investors to kind of appreciate those names and just, you know, their size, scale, all that kind of stuff.
Okay, we're coming up on our first break. This is Your Financial Futures. And the phone number is 610-758-8810. Thank you.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Lights, laughter, local celebrities, and a great cause. Tickets are now on sale for WDIY's Lehigh Valley Hollywood Squares happening Tuesday, October 27th at the State Theater in Easton. Join your favorite community personalities for a live game show with comedy, trivia, audience participation, and raffles, all benefiting WDIY. Get your tickets today at statetheater.org/event/Hollywood-squares and be part of one of the Lehigh Valley's most entertaining nights of the year.
Welcome back to Your Financial Choices. My name is Bill Henderson, and I am co-hosting tonight with Chris Holland. We both work at Valley National Financial Advisors, and we'll be taking your calls live and in the studio. The phone number is 610-758-8810. So, Chris, we started the show with a little bit of the review of the first half, and, you know, I think both of us were, you know, we've been pretty surprised at the performance of the economy, of the markets. No, but certainly it has been a really volatile 6 months. You know, a lot has gone on that, you know, caught us by surprise. But, you know, we if you look past the volatility, past the noise, it's been the right move. But, you know, I still think, you know, volatility and chaotic times are something that you have to really pay attention to. You know, is there anything out there that you think is still worthy of our time in terms of paying attention and monitoring the volatility out there?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of the data points and events that we kind of dealt with over the last 6 months, a lot of those are things that could definitely resurface. You know, there were concerns. Periodically, we get news headlines related to some large companies that are planning to, you know, kind of cut their headcount a little bit. That throws a little bit of scare into the market about, you know, just this idea, will artificial intelligence, AI, is that going to impact our labor market? Is it going to mean that companies to invest in AI to justify the cost, they're going to have to maybe pull back on their headcount a little bit? I know you and I, we get tons of research on this subject, and it seems like that topic sways back and forth week to week. But it's something that, you know, we definitely, you know, we pay a lot of attention to, you know, a strong labor market, that's kind of the cornerstone of our economy. So we need that there. You know, just other topics, you know, just sticking with the AI theme, you know, there's this constant kind of concern, are we overspending? And will these large expenditures, you know, produce some sort of return at some point in the future? And, you know, also, that's a very, you know, hot debate, a hot topic that we hear daily.
So I'll comment on both of those briefly. The labor point, I'm sort of a contrarian here. I think the AI spend will not have a drastic impact negatively on the job market. I think employees are going to become more efficient, and companies are going to become more profitable, and they'll actually hire more. Now, there's going to be massive labor shifts, so shifts from job A to job B, job C to D, mm-hmm. but I think overall, we're going to see increases in productivity, and that means more jobs, not less jobs. And I think we would be seeing the results of AI infrastructure build out right now with layoffs. If companies foresaw down the road, okay, we're going to need fewer people, let's start laying off, we're not seeing that. We're seeing, you know, solid payroll numbers continuing. And the second thing is, the are we over-investing? Are companies like Google, Meta, Apple, Amazon spending too much? Look, they're borrowing at 5%, and if they can get an ROR of 15%, you know, that's a good trade. Or if they're issuing stock and then taking that money and investing in AI, that's a good trade. Or if they're just using cash from operations. What was Google's profit margin right now? I mean, it's phenomenal.
It's just unbelievable.
Off the charts. Yeah. And they're spending like 15x what IBM is spending. They have the cash to do it. So it's not like they're going into deep debt to do this. So I think you're right. It's causing this volatility, and I think a lot of folks are looking at it from a different perspective than I am. But that's what's great. You know, that's what markets are here for.
Yep.
So
outside, maybe just one other thing, you know, that's definitely a hot topic, and It's just the outlook for interest rates and inflation specifically. You know, there's coming into this year, early part of this year, expectations were that the Fed would likely, you know, potentially start lowering rates. But here we are, you know, mid-year, and the economy is still humming, you know, at a pretty good clip. And there's some talk of a potential of a rate increase by the Federal Reserve, which, you know, there's a lot of debate on this topic as well. You know, lots of economists are trying to just kind of read the tea leaves and make predictions. There's the metric, the Fed funds futures, that we pay attention to. It gives an indication of the likelihood that the Fed is going to, you know, potentially raise rates or cut rates. And I think right now, as of this afternoon, there was like a 90% probability that there could be a rate hike before the end of the year. Now, that number swings back and forth quite a bit. It depends a lot on what economic metric was reported today. But that's definitely a hot topic. You know, you just mentioned before, you know, outside of technology, you know, it'd be great if we could get a little bit of relief or some better, just a better environment for the housing market. So if we can get interest rates, you know, I believe maybe like a month or two ago, rates started coming down a little bit. There was more of an emphasis from Washington on how could they help improve the supply situation in our housing market. So I think that got some people excited. But then just, you know, over the last week or two, I think you've seen it too. Rates have kind of back up.
I think housing is a supply issue more so than anything. There's incredible demand. We just can't build houses fast enough. Yeah. And I mean, you see it around here. I see it around where I live. There's any spot of land that they're willing to put a house or 30 houses or a giant apartment building, they're building it. But we started this cycle about maybe a million to a million and a half units short, and we can only build about a million and a half a year. Plus, we have continued ongoing demand. So that's got to work its way out. And, you know, 6.5% mortgage rates, it's not 3 like everybody was used to during the zero interest rate policy time, but it's still, relative to where interest rates have been over long periods of time, it's not a horrible rate. Now, you mentioned inflation. Another area here where I think that we spend entirely too much time is worrying, when is the Fed going to get inflation to 2%? I look back today, so I did a little prep work for here. What has inflation been the last 10 years? It's been 3.25%. So it's already been well over 2. And the S&P in that same period has increased 250%. So obviously the markets are saying, okay, we don't care that it's over 2%. We like what we're seeing, and you're seeing great returns. So I don't know if Warsh and this new Fed group is going to use one of his task forces to say, should we look at the 2% target and change it? Maybe it should be 3. You know, maybe they should call us and we'll make it some other number.
And I know, I think Diddy also mentioned that he has some research groups that he's putting in place to say, are we actually measuring inflation the right way? Are we looking at the right basket of goods and services? So it's kind of nice to hear that he's trying to, like, you know, let's kind of start fresh and really rethink maybe how we're, you know, just looking at these numbers and metrics on a month-to-month, quarter-to-quarter basis. You know, there's always a big lag effect with all the data that we get. So, you know, it's good that he's coming in with a fresh set of eyes and he's kind of eager to you know, try things a little bit differently.
One of the first bosses I worked for on the Penn Mutual Life Insurance Trading Desk, he used to go crazy when they would do CPI and then they'd say, well, X food and energy. I mean, why take out the two biggest things where people spend their money on so they can come up with some fake number?
It comes out of their bank account just like anything else.
Right. Yeah. So it's, you know, you're measuring something that isn't real in his mind, you know. But I think when we look at all the different pieces of the economy, I think inflation's one that if it stays below 4, I'm going to be okay. But I think other folks might not be. But we are coming up on our second break. Remind you that tonight your co-hosts are Bill Henderson and Chris Holland. We both work for Valley National Financial Advisors. We are taking your calls live and in the studio. Bob and Cindy are on duty. It is 610-758-8810. The name of the show, Your Financial Choices.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. on the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Are you saying out with the old, in with the new when it comes to your old car? WDIY's vehicle donation program will turn your ride into your favorite programs on Lehigh Valley Public Radio. The towing is free, all the paperwork is taken care of, and your gift is tax deductible. For more information, call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or visit wdiy.org.
Welcome back to Your Financial Choices. I'm co-hosting tonight. My name is Bill Henderson with Chris Holland. Both work for Valley National Financial Advisors. Again, we are taking your calls in the studio at 610-758-8810. So, Chris, we've reviewed the first half of 2026, talked a little bit about some of the volatility and the concerns. So I want to go back to one thing we talked about, you know, the R word, the recession. Almost every single bear market, so a period of, you know, declining stock market prices, has been preceded by a recession. And when I look at the sort of economic tea leaves, I'm not seeing a recession. You know, so one could easily say, okay, then the market's going to continue to go higher from here. But I know you don't believe that, you know, and you know, I don't. I was walking you into an explanation of why, you know, just because we're not in a bear market, it doesn't mean that we couldn't have what we had in April, which is a pretty volatile and massive correction, and corrections are good. You know, what's out there between now and the end of the year that, you know, could predicate another sell-off?
Yeah, I would say, you know, right now expectations are set very high for earnings for the remainder of the year. Now, Q1, corporate America delivered in a big way. Earnings were up double digits. And it was good to see it was more broad-based. You know, we're starting to see some good numbers being reported from non-tech companies. But I would say, you know, the concern is that raises expectations. So investors automatically think, hey, if we grew 22% or whatever the metric was in the first quarter, well, why can't we grow at that rate, you know, in Q2, Q3, Q4? So companies may, you know, there's always that risk that you know, a group or a sector or maybe just some leaders in a particular industry come out, report good numbers, but they may give guidance that's a little bit more conservative. They may say, well, we delivered good results for this quarter, but our outlook for the remainder of the year has turned a little bit more cautious. They may, you know, relate it to a consumer that's starting to spend a little bit less, where oil prices are starting to impact their spending habits, or for whatever reason it may be. That could cause a quick kind of pullback in the market where expectations need to be reset. So it's whenever, you know, the story kind of changes or catches people off guard, so to speak, that could, you know, cause people to rethink where they're invested and, you know, to just kind of recalibrate, you know, what's appropriate.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned interest rates earlier. You know, they have stabilized, like slightly higher, and that having higher interest rates does hurt a portion of the economy, a portion of the you know, the consumer, specifically lower income folks that rely on low interest rates. And if you think about the you know, a lot of people talk about the K-shaped economy. You know, higher markets have really helped the people that are invested in the markets, whereas those that are living, you know, less so or more so on paycheck to paycheck are having a tougher time with higher interest rates. But because inflation is still really sticking here, the Fed doesn't have the ability to lower interest rates right now. You know, I don't think that that's a solution. I think the better solution is to try and continue to find the things that are going to grow the economy and give more opportunities out there, better jobs, better paying jobs for people. And then rather than a K-shaped economy, which people think is bad, I think that lower part of the K really should be either flat to slightly up so that both parts of the economy are doing well. It would be much better if everybody participated, but sometimes it's tricky to do that. So we've talked a little bit about AI, especially in terms of you know spending and overspending. And, you know, people have talked about data centers. Right. And I know we have parallel investments in data centers at what we do, you and I, in the business world here. But, you know, without data centers, right, we're not going to have AI. Without AI, we're not going to have phones. You know, we're not going to have computers. So do you think the data center build out is warranted And is it something that we should be concerned about? Because you and I have seen the chart. When you look at data centers globally, it is one area where the U.S. is so much higher than the rest of the world. They don't even measure on the same chart. We have more, we have the most, and we're building the most, especially going forward.
No, I do think that they are needed. And I think it goes beyond just this whole AI theme. If you think back to even just before AI, just the need for more data centers, it was coming from cloud computing and how that has really exploded. And just think about other examples where the sheer volume of data collection. Think of a Tesla that's driving down the street and the amount of data it's collecting. So at some point, which it sounds like they're close to, they're going to be able to enable self-driving, potentially, people will not need to have their hands on the wheel. But that requires so much data to enable that. And if you kind of multiply that just simple example across all other areas of the economy, whatever it may be, just the sheer volume, we need this to make these investments. It's definitely a hot topic. It comes up daily in conversations that you and I have. We hear it on all the different news channels. I think it's necessary. But at the same time, I think we're always trying to be conscious of, where could there be some element of overspending? It's needed, but are we moving too quickly? I know just maybe two small examples to kind of point out. I know Meta, which is Facebook, they've invested in some very large data centers. And I think just a few weeks ago, they kind of made some of the capacity in one of their big data centers available to outside parties. So people kind of drew some quick conclusions and kind of were thinking, hey, did they overbuild? They don't require that data center capacity on their own. They're willing to kind of rent it out to some others. That's just one instance of an example of just, mm-hmm. You and I, this is what we do. We're looking for those data points. But I think from the very high level, we absolutely need to be making these investments.
Yeah, I think you made a really great point with the data centers were needed long before anybody heard, AI. Everything we do is stored somewhere. I mean, it's incredible when you look at your phone and how much it's collecting from you at all times. That's stored somewhere. All the data, everybody says I'm storing it in the cloud. All those pictures you take on your phone, I think I have 15,700 pictures. They're stored somewhere. They're not on my phone. They're in the cloud, and that's a data center. So it's well beyond just, artificial intelligence. It's much, much bigger, and I think that's going to continue, especially if we're going to continue to rely on phones, computers, self-driving cars. I finally did see a Waymo, by the way, out in California.
Did you see the commercials that are on TV for Waymo? They're really impressive.
It's crazy.
I look forward to when they'll be, here one day and we could give it a shot.
Yeah, so. Good luck with that. So we're going to be going into our 6:30 break, but I want to go off topic a bit, topic related.
Yeah.
What's, are there any great TV or, I guess nothing's on TV anymore. It's on all these, channels that
streaming
you have to pay for, streaming services.
That
I think I pay for and then don't even know I have them in the house. We share them with the family. But what's hot out there? What are you looking forward to?
Outside of finance and the economy, which just consumes most of our days, I am going to call out a documentary that was on YouTube, and it's about a golf course down towards, outside of the Philadelphia. It's called Cobbs Creek, and it's a very nice public course that has been just the history of how they took it from something that was really falling apart to one of the best golf courses in this area. Just a spectacular story. If anybody has a chance, go on YouTube, type in Cobbs Creek. You had the pleasure of playing there, I think, since it's been redone. I played there once or twice way back in the day because I lived close by. But just the story.
The investment they've put into that place is incredible. And Tiger Woods was one of the folks that put a lot of money into it. They have a learning center that has nothing to do with golf, by the way. It's strictly, a STEM center for folks in the city because it is in the city of Philadelphia. But I used to play there as a kid, and I've recently been there. We're talking multiple tens of millions of dollars invested to make this a world-class golf course. And they hope to get some serious PGA or USGA events there in the end. That's their plan.
And it's not just one 18-hole course. It's multiple.
Right. Yeah. All right. So we are going into our break. Remember, this is Your Financial Choices, and we are live in the studio to take your calls.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Welcome back to Your Financial Choices. My name is Bill Henderson, and I am co-hosting tonight with Chris Holland. We are both employees of Valley National Financial Advisors. Lori Siebert is on a well-deserved vacation. Okay, so Chris, welcome back to the second half of the show. We've covered a lot, but I think we still have a lot to get through, luckily, because we have another half an hour. So, you know, you and I have talked about inflation. Right. Like and I think there's a group out there that believes inflation is too high, CPI and PPI. So consumer price index and the producer price index, although they've come in sort of in expectations, meaning the street's expectations. So Wall Street economists, when even though they're not always correct, it's still above the Fed's targets. What's your view here? And historically, like looking at the long term, you know, how bad is it? Is this something that I don't hear people really complaining that much about inflation other than gas price? That's the one thing, you know, and that's not true. Food prices are there. But, you know, those are two things that at least in my 35 or 40 years have really never come down drastically either. So, you know, what do you think? Is it something that we're over worrying about, or will it? You know, come together a little bit better.
I think the Iran war is making it really, really tough for like the Fed to determine what is the underlying inflation picture really looking like. Because right now, oil prices being higher than they were, you know, 3-6 months ago, that filters throughout the economy. You know, oil touches so many different products that I think, it's definitely going to have an impact. So, I know just from the economists that we speak with that many of them have kind of, you know, we ask them this very same question, and their response typically is, well, if you could tell me when traffic through the Strait of Hormuz kind of returns to a somewhat normal level and oil prices start to come back down and that uncertainty is kind of taken out of the market, that's when people are, you know, feel like you can get a better read on inflation. But until that happens, it's just going to be very tough to know how much is tied to this one-time, war situation that we're dealing with, and how much is outside of that? How much is just inflation that seems to bubble up from like a pretty strong, healthy economy? I know just, you know, as it relates to this whole AI spending theme, there's talk of just, you know, they're called tokens. It's basically what you pay so you can have access to some of these large language models. And there's talk of just the price that one token is going to charge you or I if we want to run a sophisticated model or run a sophisticated question, how it's going up so quickly. And that could almost, bring about a certain level of inflation. Now, the good thing about that is there's, more and more competition coming into the market. So hopefully that comes back down. But there's just these other elements within the economy that I think do have, some inflationary impact.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned the costs. I think that is amazing. I think that thus far, the vast majority of AI opportunities to use AI have been free, right? And no one's paying for agents yet, or no one's really paying much. Like, I think I have ChatGPT like 5.1 or 5 point something, mm-hmm. and I pay $20 a month. I mean, that's less than I pay for a lot of these streaming services we just talked about. But I get a lot. I get unlimited chats. I can ask any dumb question I want. I can ask any, hey, plan me a trip to here. Come up with an idea for my daughter's soon-to-be wedding. Is there something I'm missing? So no one's charging for that yet. And if they are, they're charging at very slim levels. If they start to charge higher for this, all of a sudden, AI becomes either fewer people are going to use it, or it becomes really expensive. And now there's this new, I call it technology creep. And if you think about this whole technology creep is, go back 30 years, right? We didn't have phones, these types of phones. We had a phone on the wall, and we had the television. Television was free. The radio was free, and you had one phone in your house. Now we have four phones. I pay for everything to do with my television, and I pay for everything to do with any type of music in my car because I have satellite. That's all technology creep, which is insane. You know, we're paying for that. So we're all, this is what I think could happen. They're luring us in to this big AI, get used to this, get used to this. And then, you know, $20, guess what, Bill? Now it's 30, now it's 40. And I'm so hooked on it that I'm going to start paying it. And, you know, we haven't talked about that too much in the office because I think most people are like, oh, this is a great tool. It's free. But, you know, what do you think there? Is this, am I just making this stuff up?
I think that's very real. And I know there's a lot of conversations being had about, you know, some of these large language models. Should they, you know, do they need to have more offerings, more different tiers so that, you know, more dependent upon what do I need to use this tool for? Do I need to use it for some, you know, more simple tasks? Or do I need the full horsepower, the Ferrari version that, you know, just might be not necessary? So I think there's more talk about, like, how can, you know, these models be kind of tailored to what they're needed for versus having it to run a query or do the research for a simple question that's still, you know, somewhat required for a very complex question. So, and, you know, as I mentioned, like, there's more competition. There's some large language models from China that have become very competitive, and the price is much lower. And I know that's kind of raising some questions about how long can, you know, the U.S., the Anthropics of the world and the OpenAIs of the world, can they charge these premium price points? You're paying $20, but if you can get something comparable from a Chinese large language model for $1.50, but the results and the quality are just, you can't even tell the difference. You know, that it's going to create an interesting, you know, dynamic out there.
Yeah, remember last summer we had the whole DeepSeek sell-off?
Yeah.
All of a sudden everybody's worried that they're going to replace everything, and somehow that went away. But you're right about, you know, using one versus the other. I know, again, my daughter explained to me, Dad, when you use ChatGPT, you're spinning this many more servers and spending this much more electricity. You should just use Google. So now I use Google to search for certain things, but I notice Google now automatically shifts me to Gemini when I didn't even want it to do that, and it does it. So now I'm sort of wrapped in this loop of using AI when I'm trying not to. So it just happens.
They're, you know, pretty clever about that.
Yeah, I mean, the way I see it, my phone, how much does it really use? I only charge it once a day, so it's not using a lot of energy.
True.
Yeah. So I know it's using energy far away. But you mentioned it. You mentioned the Chinese models. You know, is this something, I mean, this is like, we should talk about BYD, you know, Chinese EVs. If they ever come into the United States, we're in big trouble. I mean, from what I've seen from Chinese EVs, They're the real deal. They've probably learned from Elon Musk, learned how to make a great car, changed everything, improved it all. But then you saw where Europe has severely limited Chinese imports of EVs because they pretty much wiped out their EV industry in about a year. So I don't want to hear about EVs. I want to hear, should we be worried about the DeepSeeks of the world and Chinese AI? Not because they're better, but because they're basically going to take everything that we've invented over the last 5 years, or probably way back, and just duplicate it for cheaper.
Yes, absolutely. You know, we're filming here from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. You know, used to be home of the Bethlehem Steel, and that, you know, you had these foreign steel companies that became very competitive, and they were charging, you know, prices that just weren't really sustainable. They had government support, and it really, you know, impacted the U.S. steel industry. So if we see things like that occur in the auto industry, or just as it relates to these large language models, you know, it's something that I think, you know, needs to be monitored closely. And I think it sounds like, you know, the folks in Washington are keeping a very close eye on this. To make sure that all the research and development that we're doing here in the U.S. isn't kind of being taken advantage of by some of these, you know, foreign companies. You know, we're spending hundreds of billions, maybe even trillions on this. But if there's a way that other competitors can kind of, you know, take advantage of that, it needs to be, you know, kind of dealt with.
Yep. So we have a caller. Will from Richmond, Virginia has a question about the midterm elections. You can answer first, and then I'll take a stab at it.
Uh-oh.
We'll probably answer the same, though we're pretty boring that way. What effect on the markets will there be if Republicans maintain the majority, or what effect will the markets have if the Democrats win in one or both houses? And I know we talked about this today, so it's a pretty perfect question.
Yeah, like if the Republicans, you know, kind of maintain power, I think it's status quo. I think directionally, you know, we kind of continue on this path, and the main, you know, the major focus points coming out of Washington are largely unchanged. Now, I'll let you handle the second part of that. If things change,
I think the change won't be drastic. If you really look at the numbers in the elections these days, the days of 85 seats going blue or red are gone. There's about 20 real purple regions in Congress anymore, 20. So that means there's only 20 toss-up districts. So we're not going to see a big wave one way or the other. We're not going to see – I shouldn't say we're not going to. You know, I would never make a prediction. But I don't think it's in the potential for there to be a big wave one way or the other. And most likely in midterms, almost always, the incumbent party loses seats, which means the House will probably go to the Democrats. But that'll give us this sort of status quo gridlock, which markets absolutely love gridlock, because that means nothing stupid is going to come out of Washington. No more regulations, no more things that this idea or that idea. They'll just be like, okay, we can't get anything done. Let's just keep, you know, making money off the backs of the taxpayers. And if you look back at the third year of every presidential term since 1938, it's been a positive year for the markets. So generally, because there's been a turnover one way or the other, so a Republican president now has a Democratic Congress to work with, and they're barely going to work together, so nothing bad gets done, nothing good gets done. But especially where you and I are right now in terms of what we think the economy is going to do, I think we're still in a really good shape to continue to grow the economy. At least like 6 months out. Beyond that, it's really tough to predict. But if both the House and the Senate were to flip to Democrats, that's the second part of Will's question, that's also highly unlikely. It's really hard to...
Do you think that's ever happened in the past? Has that ever happened?
You got me. I have
really?
No idea.
Okay.
I'm sure it has, you know, because something... Everything's always happened.
Put that in the ChatGPT or something.
Yeah. No, you use Google. It's cheaper.
Okay.
But if it does, you know, you're talking... Senators every 6 years, the Congress folks, which really are House representatives, every 2 years, so it's easier to flip those seats. You're not... An incumbent person has a much higher ability to stay elected, which is really all they want to ever do, which is just... mind-boggling and angers me more than anything that's their main objective. So I don't think that will happen, but if it does, I think that would add a new layer of uncertainty that maybe the markets would have a tough time digesting. So it would put President Trump in the situation of vetoing a lot of bills mm-hmm. that he didn't like, because they could just keep sending stuff at him. They don't control the Senate. It's not veto-proof, or it could be veto-proof. You know, anything could happen.
Yeah, it's kind of like a tail risk.
Yeah, there you go. We finally found the tail risk that you and I are worried about. So, okay, as we move into our next and final break, tell me, is there a movie, not a television show, but a movie that you would recommend? And if not, I'll take my own.
You take this one.
Okay,
like,
so
I'm in a dry spell right now as far as good movies.
I just saw Disclosure Day.
Ooh.
about a month ago, and it was interesting. You know, I'm a big sci-fi guy. I love growing up. I love
Steven
Star
Spielberg,
Trek.
Right?
Yeah, I love Star Trek. I love all the Star Wars movies. So it was good. It kept me intrigued the entire time, which is tough for me. I have a very low attention span, as you probably can guess by listening to me on the radio. But I mean, it managed to keep me in my seat the whole time. And I would recommend it.
Great. My daughter wants to go see it, so we're going to give it a try. Thanks,
so you're
Bill.
Listening to Your Financial Future, Your Financial Choices. And I'm Bill Henderson, along with Chris Holland.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
WDIY 88.1 offers many choices and real voices. Folk music, from folk classics to the Gaelic traditions of the British Isles, to bluegrass and old-time music of Appalachia, to the modern-day singer-songwriters telling the story of today's world. You'll find it all here on WDIY. Listen and enjoy the wide variety of folk music every weekday evening, 7 to 9 p.m., just after NPR News headlines, and Sunday mornings at 11 a.m. on 88.1 WDIY and streaming at WDIY.org.
Welcome back to Your Financial Choices. I am in the studio. My name is Bill Henderson, along with Chris Holland. We are sitting in for Lori Siebert, who is on vacation. We are taking your calls live and in the studio. The phone number is 610-758-8810. So, Chris, a lot has happened in fixed income. You know, yields are pretty attractive right now.
Yeah, what's your, Bill, that's your background. You're a 25-year veteran, a portfolio manager for BlackRock. Just curious to kind of get inside your mind a little bit. Like, we heard Warsh speak, I believe it was last week, and gave a lot of testimony about his plans, his thinking for the future. We've seen some economic metrics come in. What's your thinking on just the overall fixed income market and maybe where there's some opportunity there?
Yeah, I think there, you know, if you look back the last 10 or 15 years, we are in a really fantastic time period for opportunities in fixed income. And it's simple. It's, these aren't risky opportunities. You can get on a, you know, a portfolio that's slightly short the ag, and the ag is this sort of, it's called the Bloomberg aggregate. It's just, if you think about the S&P 500 as an index of, mm-hmm. of 500 equities, the aggregate is the closest thing we can come up with to an index of bonds. It's flat year through the year, meaning it hasn't gone up or down in price, but the yield on a portfolio that has a duration of about 6 years is giving you, you know, 5.5 to 6%, right? And that's a really good return. If you shorten that and say, let's make maybe a portfolio of say 2 years to 3 years, which has very little risk. Remember, if interest rates rise, prices go down, and then the opposite. So bonds are risky. If you want a little less risk, you can still get close to 4%. I mean, money market returns are still north of 3%. So opportunities in fixed income, which we haven't seen
long time
in a while, are here. And, you know, we always used to say fixed income adds ballast to the portfolio, except when you look back at 2022 when they both blew up. But right now, the ballast from fixed income is not really in potential total return, because I don't think the Fed's going to do enough to have a big total return, meaning a movement in prices. I think it's come from yield. Your ballast is the yield that a fairly balanced fixed income portfolio is going to provide your portfolio. So at the end of the year, you look at your portfolio and you go, wow, I got a dividend of, you know, 4.5, 5, 6% on a pretty simple fixed income portfolio, whether it's bonds, mutual funds, or ETFs, all of which are fairly easy to find or invest in. You get a pretty decent return, which helps offset, you know, the 10, 11, 12% you're getting in equities. But remember, that comes with a lot of volatility.
And like, that's in a backdrop where, you know, we continue to see, you know, record tight, not record tight, but very tight credit spreads. You know, we've heard earnings releases from some of the biggest banks and Wall Street firms. And they've kind of provided a pretty encouraging update. Their numbers look very good, but they usually talk a little bit about credit markets on their earnings calls. And I think they gave a pretty comfortable and kind of, you know, somewhat positive outlook, which is always good to hear. So,
You mentioned credit spreads. I mean, you and I know, you know what that means. I know what that means. But you said credit spreads are tight, especially in high yield. There's like two sentences there that need explanation. So high yield and then credit spreads. So, all right. So high yield is just a nice fancy way of saying junk bonds. So remember, higher risk, but, you know, high yield, meaning you're getting a higher yield. Why are you getting a higher yield? It's a higher risk. So they used to be called junk bonds, and then that became a bad word, so they called them high yield. It sounds really fancy.
It sounds friendly.
Yeah,
okay.
Nice. High yield. Let me buy high yield. No, junk bonds. And then the second are credit spreads. So credit spreads are, how much more am I getting to own a junk bond over, say, a treasury bond? And if it's 100 basis points or 1%, that's the spread. 1% over treasuries. Everything is sort of gauged off of treasury bonds. And like you said, credit spreads right now are really tight, meaning narrow. You're not getting paid a lot to own high yield or junk bonds. So I would say that's an area where there's opportunity, but it's small opportunity because spreads are tight. And when there's a problem, and, you know, we're always looking for problems, they're the things that blow out first. Spreads widen out, and that's when, you know, instead of getting 100, maybe you get 300, 400, 500 on junk bonds, you know, where it should be.
Makes sense.
So let's talk a little bit about areas in healthcare that can be driven by – I know I'm switching gears on you – on driven by AI. We really – most of the time people talk about AI, they don't give how it's going to help. They just say AI this, AI that, but not don't really – you and I use it, and I know how I use it, you know, all over the place. I use it for my own. I use it a little bit at work in terms of, you know, Grammarly helps you make sure that your writing is flawless. But, you know, in terms of healthcare and research, we are seeing a lot there, and that's an area where, you know, I know you've done a little bit of work on that subject, and I thought maybe you could talk about that.
Yeah, like if you think about like the much bigger picture and the much larger potential that AI can kind of bring to our economy and our society, just think about the R&D costs that, you know, pharmaceuticals have paid and the process to get a particular drug from just research all the way through the clinical trial process to it being approved. Like AI is definitely going to impact this. And this is, you know, we've heard comments like this from like Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan. He's very optimistic about the long-term potential of AI and what it can mean for healthcare. And you know, you listen to certain experts who do have put out some predictions that they could see AI being a driving force behind what could bring about, you know, cures in certain areas like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or even different types of cancer. It just, you know, provides this level of research that, you know, prior would take 10 years or 20 years to complete can be, you know, condensed down to a much shorter time period. So while the day to day, like you said, the conversation is about Google selling tokens so that you and I can perform certain daily tasks much more quicker, more efficiently. I think some of these really large hyperscalers are looking at the really, really big problems that we face in our society. And I think that's what their end goal potentially could be more geared towards. The selling you and I tokens is hopefully going to allow them to pay the bills and continue to invest. But I think they're looking, you know, to really make some major breakthroughs in areas like healthcare, or even energy. You know, when you think about just, you know, the level of research and development that could be put into, you know, just how could we make some big breakthroughs in, like, you know, fusion energy or whatever it may be, things that were just that at one point were thought to be insurmountable because it just, you know, it requires too much money, too much research to kind of make any big breakthroughs. But now we kind of have this incredible, you know, new set of tools in the toolbox that hopefully can, you know, unlock some of these possibilities.
Yeah, energy is a big one, and I'll talk about that in one second. One good book about healthcare, it's called Eat Your Ice Cream. It's by Ezekiel Emanuel, and he works at he's a professor at Penn in Philadelphia, also a brother of Rahm Emanuel, the former chief of staff for Obama. But it's an excellent book around how you can make, you know, simple changes to your life and improve your health. And it's really good. And he was on he was actually on NPR. Terry Gross had him on to discuss it.
No way.
One of our, you know, partners in the business.
Cool.
You know, in the public radio business. So you mentioned energy, and everyone is sort of dancing around the one big thing out there, which is everything AI is going to use up an incredible amount of energy. It already is. And one thing I like is the hyperscalers, so, you know, they're the Metas, the Amazons, Googles that have the money, are saying, hey, we're going to build this giant data center, but guess what? We're going to buy TMI, so Three Mile Island, for those of you in Pennsylvania, and we'll rehab it, we'll get it working again, and we'll use the energy from that, you know, previously mothballed nuclear power plant to fund or to fuel our data centers. That's one solution, but, you know, you look at the rest of the world, they're all embracing nuclear energy. And, you know, we need to really get on board there. Do you see a solution outside of nuclear energy in terms of, you know, solving the energy problem that we could see from AI?
Well, I kind of think we had almost like a little bit of like an energy problem before AI ever, you know, really even showed up. Like, there was plenty of research out there that kind of indicated the U.S. was under investing in our national grid. It was like an aging system. And then when you kind of put some of these other elements on top of it, like, you know, the data center build out that was kind of underway before AI even really showed up, it kind of just enhanced, you know, this problem that we're facing. So, you know, when people talk about like the derivative plays off of this whole AI build out theme, like there's certain construction and engineering companies that are doing extremely well because all of a sudden everybody need, like you said, that we need power to be able to kind of enable all these data centers to kind of do their job. And it's a very big investment. A lot of these things take many, many years to kind of put in place. It's not a quick build.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as, you know, outside of nuclear, it's tough to say, like, you know, what could really, you know, impact things more than that.
It worries me that our regulatory process is so small for nuclear energy. I mean, these small modular reactors, I think, would be a great way to do it. But this is where we need to keep our edge over China. You know, China is making a race to become a better AI player than we are. I mean, we invent all the stuff. We're the innovators. China then imitates, and Europe spends its time regulating rather than doing either of the above. But I think in order to stay in front of this, we need to figure out a way to provide plenty of power to our AI industry to continue to do what it needs to do. As long as we see return on investment, you know, and I still think that right now Wall Street's saying, great, you know, invest, spend the CapEx on AI, spend the CapEx to expand and hire and grow and build and buy, and they're getting away with it. But eventually, we're going to need to see real returns on all this stuff. And I think the investment, it can't just be perpetual investment. You know, it's got to be returns on that. And, you know, do you see a concern in terms of, you know, we've double-digit earnings growth, right? Didn't you say double-digit earnings growth for quite a number of years now? That's phenomenal. And that's a big driver of the economy. You know, that's an area where people are not even paying attention to that except for, like, Wall Street analysts. But I think that's important. You know, how long before the AI build actually produces, you know, results that are actionable? You can look and say, we increased our bottom line because of this. That's a pretty big question, I know.
And that's kind of come up in some recent, you know, conversations as well. It's like there are companies that will, you know, publish research on every single word that is mentioned on a company's earnings conference call. And they'll do that for every single public company. And I think I've shown you some of this research. Yeah. I think Goldman Sachs puts it out and they'll count every time, you know, a CEO says the word AI and says the word jobs after it, or AI, and says CapEx and all these different combinations. And I think one area that a lot of people are looking forward to or are kind of waiting for is, when are we going to see more companies say, we beat our earnings estimates by a wide margin because of AI? It allowed us to bring a new product to market faster, or it allowed us to take costs out of our business.
So this reminds me of a famous movie quote.
Uh-oh.
You better not miss this. When am I going to see some arrest slips at the end of this rainbow?
I think that would be Beverly Hills Cop.
That's right. So when am I going to see some earnings at the end of this AI rainbow?
That's a great one.
You know, like, we really need, I think it'll happen. I think it's going to be sketchy too. You're going to see some companies that are, oh, well, we bought it because everybody else was and, you know, it didn't produce, or we're going to see a lot that are. So we are coming up to the end of the show. Thank you all for listening to Your Financial Choices. My name is Bill Henderson. I'm Chief Investment Officer at Valley National Financial Advisors. And then my co-host tonight was Chris Holland, Director of Research and Investments. It's been our pleasure to host the show and take your questions. Thank you and have a great rest of the night.
Have a good night.